Good morning, man. My name is Gino and I am an alcoholic. Happy Easter, everyone. I am sober by the grace of God and practicing the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm absolutely honored and privileged to be here today amongst you. And thanks, Jimmy, for asking me to share. And thank you guys for showing up here and your support. I tell you, I'm a big fan of the men who trudge. And it's been a big part of my life these past few years, especially since COVID hit. So all I ask of you men is that you identify with what I have to say and not compare with me. And I'm just going to share my experience, strength, and hope. A lot of you guys know me, so if you catch me lecturing or pontificating on anything, please just jump in and say, "Hey, Gino, back to your experience. Stay away from trying to teach everybody things." Because in the divine wisdom and an intervention of the founders, they knew guys like me existed out there as alcoholics and with the overconfidence. And it's best that we just stick to our experience, our strength, and our hope. So let me just qualify here quickly on what is it that makes me an alcoholic, and how is it that I come to sit here in front of you men here today and tell my story. I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1986, in October of 86. So I've been coming to these meetings for a little while. I was a youngest of a large South Buffalo family, youngest of eight, and the age spanning is 18 years. My oldest sister's 18 years older than me, and my parents were 41 when I was born. So they were pretty far along in life when I came into the picture. And I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood where there's a, I don't know, a church in on every street, on every corner, and followed after that was a bar. So I don't know, it's always a joke. Are there more bars or churches in South Buffalo? And it's just kind of the neighborhood I grew up in, Irish neighborhood. And just a regular, grew up regular, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of mysteries in my life. My sister was in college when I was born. So I kind of always knew that I'd be going to college. There wasn't a big mystery in that. And a lot of my life was laid out in front of me because of my older brothers and sisters and what was expected. And I guess I just grew up in a normal middle-class family. A lot of my sisters and brothers, my sisters and my cousins, I have a huge family with cousins and aunts and uncles. They're mostly cops, firefighters. Teachers, nurses, middle class. And that's kind of what I was expected to do. I actually became a Buffalo firefighter, retired recently, and was a professional firefighter for 28 years. But, you know, those kind of humble beginnings in South Buffalo, there's also an element in South Buffalo where there's a lot of drinking. And as far as the drinking goes, I don't know. I might have been a kid that had whiskey put on his gums because baby orange cost too much. Just couldn't afford it. And, you know, got sent to the fridge to get beers. And I knew how to open beers at a very young age. Though there wasn't alcohol around the house very often, I can remember my first drunk. I may have been 9 or just turned 10 years old. My niece, who was born in 1980, at her christening. Which was right before my birthday or near my 10th birthday. There's a keg in the backyard, and me and a neighbor kid, Eddie, got some styrofoam cups, and we snuck beers off the keg and got drunk. And I blacked out, and I puked, and I passed out. And I woke up and can't really tell you much more than that, that me and Eddie got drunk together, and nobody made a big deal of it. I didn't get yelled at or grounded or anything. And honest to tell you, not much changed in the next 12 years as far as drinking goes. I blacked out. I was a blackout drunk from day one. And I thought that was normal. And a lot of stuff I'm going to talk about in regards to my drink and qualifying here, I did not know till I got sober. I did not know that that kicked in the obsession to someday somehow control and enjoy my drinking, that I would spend the next 12 years trying not to black out and not puke. I didn't even know that puking was alcohol poisoning, that I had poisoned myself. I'd learn all that stuff later. Like I said, I wasn't alone. I don't know how old you, what, 10 years old was I? Maybe fourth grade, fifth grade. Then I started drinking with my buddies because that's normal. I mean, there really are in South Buffalo social drinkers at 10, 11 years old. There's not where I live and where I've lived for the last 20 years, but growing up, there was. I wasn't inventing anything. I was just following along in a path that had been well worn before I was ever born. By the time I was 14 years old, eighth grade, I could drink a pint of vodka by myself. And I was very proud of that. I was 54 cents for a pint of Mr. Boston, or a little cheaper for Domchatka vodka, some rock gut stuff. And I could drink that by myself at 14. That is not normal. But this obsession that I didn't even know that I had to control and enjoy it meant that the poor kid here had to get the maximum out of his money. I drank things like Wild Irish Rose, Mad Dog 2020, Tango, he's called Wango Tango, that rock cut Domchatka stuff. The girls were pretty sharp in South Buffalo. They taught us to put little packets of Kool-Aid and shake it up. Now you pay extra for that. They sell all the vodkas now, I guess, flavored. But back then you'd add back in the 80s you would add Kool-Aid to it. Again, none of this by myself. Hanging out, I'm the poor kid, come up to the corner. Back when you had to get buyers, and me and how many of my buddies got together, we'd pool our money and we'd look at each other. And they used to have Jenny Pounders. I don't know if you guys remember 50-cent Pounders, as a 16-ounce Jenny Pounder. And we go, well, 12-pack of Jenny Pounders ain't doing it. And we'd either get the half gallon of vodka or a gallon of wine or something stronger that we knew would get us all buzzed up. Marijuana also came into the picture. Smoked a lot of weed. My idea was I was always doing something. And I learned early on that if I smoked weed and drank, that it was an instant blackout. I was going to definitely go on an instant blackout. So it was one or the other for me. I didn't mix the two. And I'm the guy who thought smoking weed was sober because I wasn't blacking out and getting in trouble. And that started my journey at a very, very young age. And I had no control whatsoever, really, over the amount that I took and in what was going to happen to me. The good times is when I didn't black out and didn't get in trouble. And I can see it very, very clearly now from where I'm sitting that I never had a chance to drink like the way that I was drinking at the young age that I was at was a problem. And the people in my family, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we say, oh, we can't diagnose anyone an alcoholic. Well, that's kind of half truth. Because the following line says, but yeah, go to the bar and try some controlled drinking and see how well that works for you. Because anyone like me is likely to stay sober for a month, let alone a year. And the world was telling me I was an alcoholic at a young age, and it was hard to accept. Growing up in that environment where everyone's a drunk and they're looking at me saying, you got the problem. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I got the problem. We're all drinking together. And they knew something was different about me. My buddies knew something was different about me. The education system knew there was something different about me. I started getting arrested. My father died. I was 15 years old. And I like to say that if there's a date on a calendar that says that there's no coming back through human aid for this alcoholic, that's the date, February 6, 1986. I was 15 years old. And I can remember that night drinking in my mother's kitchen, Kessler's, doing shots of Kessler's, drinking a blue can of beer. I don't know if it was Labatt's or what it was. Just that the can of beer was blue, sitting around a bunch of guys my age right now, if you can believe it. I'm 54 years old right now. And guys that my father was 56. So guys my age, sitting there with a 15-year-old doing shots of Kessler's, drinking beer the night before the funeral, telling me stories about my father, Korean War. Stories. He was a Korean War Marine, and just tell me about him. And that's normal in South Buffalo. I can honestly tell you, man, that I would never drink with a 15-year-old. I have children, three of them, and I am not a part of their peer group. But that was normal in South Buffalo at that time. And 6 months after that, I wound up in an AA meeting because by that time, everybody knew I had a problem, out of control. And I tried everything I possibly could to just catch a buzz and not get in trouble. I'm the kid who went to school with a backpack full of beer. And that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll mention, he's been Donnie Byers and Booner McBride. two members of Alcoholics Anonymous that both died sober. They're my father's friends. And I thought they were just trying to scare me. They took me up to the VA hospital. Everybody in my family knew. My mother's name was Pat. And they're like, Pat, this one's got a problem. He's got a pad. I had already had a cousin who died of alcoholism that I was unaware of. There were so many members of my family that had alcoholism that had died or were struggling with it that I was just unaware of. The bondage itself, plus my youth, just being a young kid, not knowing that alcoholism was in the family, I couldn't see it. But my family could. And they knew that I had the problem, as well as my friends did. They knew that I was different when it came to drinking, even at that young age. But because of this illness, because of this utter inability to just see it, I didn't know how bad I was. And now if I go to the VA and they're telling me that, wet brain, if you're not familiar with wet brain, that you go into, my understanding of it is you go into the blackout and you don't come out. Your brain really gets deteriorated and through the abuse of alcohol, and you lose your personality. And they were telling me about jails, institutions, and death, and all these great things that happen to alcoholics. And I thought they were trying to scare me. I didn't realize that they were telling me the truth about my illness and what they could see. And they took me up to the 10th floor, which is called the flight deck. Well, it used to be at the VA. And there's the guys that had the wet brain. And they're in the wheelchairs and they're puddles of men. At that time, I could not envision these men as soldiers, as strong, vibrant men, living life, chasing women, doing a thing that strong men do, running around doing their gig. I just seen puddles of men in wheelchairs. And then they took me down to the fourth floor where the meeting was, and there's this guy, George, who I got to know later, and he was in slippers, and he had 15 years of sobriety and relapsed. And their jaws dropped, and they're in shock that George was at the VA because he was one of these AA icons. And he had a relapse and drank over the weekend. And right there, I thought, see, this is all bullshit. This doesn't work. You guys are just trying to do scare tactics. And, besides, I'm too young, too smart, and too good looking to be an alcoholic. And, that's kind of was my attitude. And sometimes today, I think I'm too young, too smart, and too good looking to be an alcoholic, but that's why we got 12 steps. But at that time, I was like, this is all BS. And I continued to drink. Shortly after that, I took my sister's car for a joyride and got a DWI. I wound up living at my brother's house. My oldest brother, called it Camp Mike affectionately in my family, where the family's trying to intervene and help me. And I know some of you men have done the same for your family members. I was a 17-year-old kid trying to get through summer school so I could graduate high school, and making all those promises at that young age. And I developed that other thing of alcoholism that few of us understand. Don't judge me on what I'm doing. Don't judge me on what's going on. Let's talk about all my potential and the great things I'm going to do in the future. You'll see once I graduate school and I get into college, you'll see how awesome I am. Let's not talk about what's going on in the past. Let's focus on the future. And that was a mindset that I was in and that I was always in. And I guess you could say that I was unaccountable. I'm an unaccountable alcoholic. And I don't want to suffer the consequences of what goes on with alcoholism. And I'm the guy that would always come to meetings because I was in trouble. I'm the guy that from 1986 to 1993 went to, I don't know, 1,000 AA meetings, developed a cocaine addiction, became a daily pot smoker, did all, every kind of drug that came my way, and drank profusely. Tried to master Jack Daniels. That vodka was my go-to. I got my ass whooped by Mr. Boston, Jack Daniels. Jose Cuervo and did not do well, man. The boys would gang up on me, but I was determined to just try to catch a buzz. That's what I was trying to do. I did not understand, even though that I'd been all those lived in a home limit illness is progressive. The consequences are progressive. And that the main characteristic is that I'm obsessed with the idea that someday, somehow, I can control and enjoy my drinking. If you could beat alcoholism out of me, like physically beat it out of me, I would have gotten sober in high school because I took a lot of physical beatings. I got beat at home for my behaviors. I got beat on the streets for my behaviors. If marijuana was a treatment for alcoholism, you guys, I would not be talking to you guys right now because I tried that. And the best I could do was did a couple years and I drank again and things got really bad, awful, immediately. Uncontrollable, raging alcoholism. I wound up in jail. If sex was it, I always had girlfriends, never had a problem there. And those were all the things that I thought would fix it, man. If I just got the right girl, if I had enough money, good enough grades, the right friend group, cleaned up nice. Never in my life was I getting ready to go out to party and thought, geez, I think I'll go out tonight, rob somebody's money off the bar, cheat on my girlfriend, start a fight, get arrested, and wake up in jail and embarrass my family and disgrace myself. Never in my life. But those things would happen to me. And I would promise myself to never act that way again, to never have those things occur again. And I couldn't stop them. And that was troubling. To getting in trouble, to puke and that kind of stuff, I could deal with that. But the long faces of my family and friends, being basically kicked out of friend groups, my family telling me move to Cleveland because we don't know anybody there. And if this is how you're going to act, you're a disgrace in the family. You're an embarrassment. And we got this saying in AA, which I don't subscribe to. If hell is for people that are religious. And spirituality is for people who've been to hell. I don't believe in that because most of the stuff I'm talking to you men about, I don't remember the circumstances. I was reminded recently of an episode when I was in high school where I threw up. It's lucky I didn't die. And I was in my room at my mother's house. It was a tile floor. And I literally, my face got stuck to the floor because the puke melted, you know what I mean? It dried. And my hair and my face was stuck to the floor. I don't remember this. I was told this. And I woke up screaming because my face and my hair was stuck to the floor. And if you've ever like tried to just pull your hair, it hurts really bad. And I'm trying to get my face off the floor and I was stuck. And my sister, who's 10 years older than me, and my niece, who's 10 years younger than me, so I don't know, my niece was 5 years old, 6 years old, literally had to get warm water, pour the warm water on the floor to loosen up the dried puke. So that I could get my face off the floor. And that was like a Wednesday.
I think that's enough of a drunk log. Hey guys, did I qualify there as a drunk, you think?
I don't know. You were stuck to the floor last we heard.
All right. Well, that's a good place to pick up from. I was stuck to the floor. It's kind of embarrassing. My point is that I don't remember that, but my sister and my niece do. When I got arrested in the driveway that last time, I fought with the cops. One of them went to the prom with my older brother. I don't remember this. My mother does. She watched it all go down. The girl behind the counter at Dickie's Donuts that I harassed gave me my first paper route. She lived across the street, and the people who owned Dickie's Donuts were neighbors of ours. I grew up with their kids. Just shameful. I don't remember any of it. That's a pretty big miss in behavior and personality, and I couldn't see it. And that's how I rolled into Alcoholics Anonymous the last time for good. That was my last drunk. And that started my journey. Since that day, it was March 30th, 1993, is when I woke up in that jail cell. And I have known since that day that I am alcoholic. I could hear it resoundingly in my head: jails, institutions, and death. And there I was, the kid who thought he was too smart, too good looking to be an alcoholic. The prophecy came true. There's no mystery to that. And the only reason why I'm alive today, I believe, is because of this physical ability to take the punishment. It says our illness is twofold. We got the mental illness that says, hey, someday, somehow, man, I'll catch a buzz. I'll just catch a buzz. No, I don't want to get arrested. I'm not a socio or a psychopath. I'm just a drunk. I want to do regular things that everybody else is doing. And I can't do it because I always get drunk. But the reason why I don't die from, I'm not the frat boy in college who died from drinking too much, is because My body is physically different. I metabolize it different. Yes, there's a craving element where I want more and more and more. One's too many and a thousand ain't enough. But there's also an ability for me to indulge at massive quantities that would normally kill a regular person, I believe. But because I'm alcoholic, I'm able to sustain that punishment because I'm physically different. Where my buddies, they puke on Jack Daniels, they're done. We ain't drinking Jack Daniels again. And I will spend a whole summer trying to get it down, if you can identify with that. So I've learned those things, which led me to what? I'm not meant for jail. I'm not meant to live alone. I don't want to live in Cleveland where I don't know anybody. I like you guys. I like being a part of the crowd. I do. I like just, I'm a regular American guy. You know, meet a pretty girl, get a nice house, get a good career, go on vacation, be one of the guys. And I couldn't do it as an active alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous promised me a life beyond my wildest dreams. The things that mattered most to me were you never have to wake up in jail again. That was a big deal. And then when I returned to the meetings, one of the first guys that I met was George Fitz. And he was sober. It was a huge meeting, South Buffalo meeting. And 100 people, at least, tons of tables. And he was a guy standing there at the coffee pot when I returned to Alcoholics Anonymous after getting arrested. And he didn't wag his finger at me. He didn't say, "See, I told you so." He looked at me and he said, "You ready, kid?" And he had stayed sober since that time at the VA. And I was like, "Yeah." And he knew it. He could see it on my face. He goes, "Well, it'll work for you like it worked for me." That mattered to me, that hope. And that man stayed sober till the day he died. I got to know him pretty well, and his wife, who was part of Al-Anon, his daughter, actually sponsored his grandson at one point because we were close in age. What an honor and a privilege, huh? The life that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. I didn't have to live in that hell. Literally saved that last 10 or 15 years of hell. I'm the kind of guy that doesn't get to live long. I don't. I've seen guys that have alcoholism, you know, late stage alcoholism, young like I did, usually die from an overdose or something awful. I've seen it. And my ego won't allow me to live like that anyways. I'm definitely a candidate for the ultimate insanity of suicide. Which, where does that leave us at that second step? And I had real issues with that. And it wasn't so much that I didn't believe in God. I didn't think I was worthy of God. You know, on Easter Sunday, I am a Catholic. And my mother taught me faith. I got to give my mother a lot of credit here. She read at Mass. She was a lectern. And she was also a Eucharistic minister. And we were raised religious. And she taught me faith. She taught me religion. And I was thinking of this not that long ago as I'm working with another alcoholic and we're talking about faith. And, you know, every week I'd go to church and there's my mom reading out of the book, you know, and I know the story. She taught me the Bible without me even realizing it. Kind of like my father, who was a mechanic, taught me how to fix cars by just standing there holding the flashlight. I didn't realize he was teaching me how to do brake jobs and change alternator belts just by standing there with a flashlight, knowing what tools I had. My mother taught me faith. But my problem at being an alcoholic the way that I am, some of the things that I described, was I was ashamed of myself. And I didn't think I was good enough for God. And then I had that other problem where I got this cynicism. And I come in Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I had spent years around, I thought I knew something. Because I knew the language, you know, and how all the meetings opened and I could talk at meetings. I didn't know anything. I was scared to death. I truly was. And I started off with that, the simplicity of Alcoholics Anonymous. That you just need to believe in something greater than yourself, right? And that something was a group of drunks. And I started off at Abbott Men's down there on Saturday mornings. And got a sponsor. That became my home group. And I was pretty much convinced that if I didn't make it to my home group on Saturday morning, I would drink. I just was. I was in a lot of trouble. I went to rehab for a get out of jail free card. I don't know if you can identify with that. And I was doing everything that I possibly could to stay out of jail. I still had this idea that if that a woman could fix me. 2 days out of rehab, I hooked up with a girl from Alcoholics Anonymous. She had 2 years of sobriety. I had 2 days out of rehab. And we hooked up on a Saturday night, and we created a boy named Adam. And because that's just how I was living at 22 years old. If she liked me, I'm not that bad. I would learn that going through the steps later, that that was really a sex and comfort was something that I needed. These distractions that I had from the miserable life I was living, this pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that I had suffered because of my alcoholism. I was desperate to change the way that I felt. And if a girl liked me, it changed the way I felt. And it made me feel like I wasn't that bad. And it didn't work out between her and I. It actually took us longer to get divorced than we were married. I don't have a problem with her. She's still sober. She's sober longer than me. She just celebrated 34 years of sobriety. But it did work out between me and my son. And I got custody of him at 3 years old, when he was 3 years old. And I'm currently married for 25 years and had two children with another woman. And Selma are walking around my house. And she's a good woman. So it's a little of my background there. But that weren't going to save me. And it's really sucks, man. It's heartbreaking when you're convinced that, like, the right relationship is going to fix you, and it doesn't. Having money is going to fix you, and it doesn't. Having the right friend group, it doesn't fix you. It's awful when you're convinced, and you don't even know that that's self-reliance. You can't see it, that you're relying upon the wrong stuff. And having that underlying shame that I'm not good enough for God to restore me to what? Sanity. So I can stop walking around like a lunatic. I'm not even talking about the insanity of the drink. I'm talking about the crazy conversations that we have in our head in early sobriety. And the continuation of not wanting to act certain ways and being constitutionally capable of stopping myself from being dishonest, from showing up late to work, from not paying my bills on time, from not feeling worthy and not fitting in, and all the insecurities and the low self-esteem and just the lust of everything that goes on with us when we put down the drink that now we're acutely aware of, that insanity and everything that I was trying to do. And unfortunately, and it was devastating, that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't going to fix me, because I started to get super cynical, the group of drunks that I was looking to for guidance. And I started cynically dissecting all the people around me. I was really good at taking everybody else's inventory. I don't know about you guys, but my first superpower that I got upon getting sober was the ability to read minds. So I'm not going to call my sponsor because I know what he's going to say. And I'm not going to bring this topic up at the beginner's table because I know what they're going to say. And I certainly am not going to tell Jim what's going on in my head because I know what he's going to say. And so I'll just keep it all to myself. That's, you know, the old timers had a solution to that. We're only as sick as our secrets. I didn't make that correlation for a little while. But thank God that I stopped reading minds and I started talking about what was really going on. Being terrified that I wasn't going to be a good enough father, that I was going to be a failure as a man. Because that's all I've ever wanted to do, was to just be a regular guy, get along, pay my bills, do the things that men do. And I couldn't do it until I started to go through these steps. Alcoholics Anonymous ruined my drinking. Absolutely ruined my drinking. But the 12 steps ruined my relapses. I've been a sober man since I've gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for that. And my journey with coming to know God was not an easy one. I did a lot of, you know, out there looking at Buddhism and Confucianism and reading the world's religions and the seven spiritual principles and reading all kinds of wordy books. And I wound my way back around to the religion that my mother had taught me, Catholicism. And enough things occurred in my life that God was unmistakable to me. Just, I couldn't deny it. Like, just in terms of like praying to God to get me out of that jail cell, God saved the least version of me. The least version, I'm praying the least version, the worst version, that drunk, drug addict, lying, cheat that steals from his neighbors, that steals from his mother, that fights with the cops, that embarrasses his family. I mean, that version of me is I'm praying is the worst version. God save that version. I'm probably 18 months into this before I realized I was begging God to get out of jail. And it wasn't anything that I did that got me out of jail. God got me out of jail. The worst version he saved. Not the guy today who's retired and living life well, married for 25 years, three kids. No. God saved the worst version of me. It took time for me to see that. Just like when I was begging for the obsession to be removed, because I'm going to meetings, I'm doing all the stuff we're supposed to do, and I'm still thinking, take a drink. Buy diapers. No, take a drink. Pay your electric bill. Take a drink. Oh, I don't want to drink. Ah, if you know that, it's you. You know, run. Leave her. Take off, right? Don't be a father. The craziness. The unaccountable alcoholic. The guy that doesn't want to have the consequences of what? Life. On life's terms. And I'm praying to God and God's showing up. I'm thinking about drinking and there's a guy from AA. Call him God shots. Call him a God moment. I don't care what you call it. I had one happen a few years ago. Last time I thought about drinking was I was in Ireland. I was 30 years sober. It was we had gone to the Bills game in London and then flew into Ireland. And my wife's like, come on, let's go. And we're walking through the streets. And I have a very simple understanding of powerlessness. If I'm thinking about taking a drink, tell on myself. Period. Tell on myself and say a prayer. Please, God, save me. That's it. If it gets more complicated than that, man, I'm in a lot of trouble. I can't memorize all this literature, know all the right people, and have the perfect home group and sponsor. It's got to be as simple as, hey, I'm thinking about drinking. Help me out. It's never failed. That's how Bill and Bob met. I think we read it at the beginning of the meeting. New York stockbroker picked up a phone and called for some help, right? And I pray that never fails me and that I'm forever humble enough to raise my hand and say I'm in trouble. But we're walking through. I go, hey, where are we going? We're kind of in a sketchy neighborhood. It's a travel day. She looks at me and she goes, we're going to Guinness. And I think to myself, ooh, maybe I could just swish it around in my mouth and spit it out. That was my thought. I'm crossing the street. If you've ever been to Ireland, they're pretty short streets. My wife and I have an understanding. We've had this since before we got married. We've been together 28 years. That if I was ever to think about drinking, I will tell her. And if we got to leave, we leave, period. I don't care where we are or what we're doing. It's just understood. And so then the debate starts. I'm crossing the street, and it's like, tell her, don't tell her. I get to the other side of the street, and on the other side of the street, there's a building. It's like a huge wall. It is the national headquarters of Narcotics Anonymous in Ireland. It was like a billboard. It wasn't like a little sign. It was like God saying, hey, stupid, just do what you know, practice the principles. And I looked at my wife and I said, hon, I was thinking about swishing around, spitting out. She goes, are you okay? You all right? I go, no, it's just a thought. I don't even want to drink. I just want to, you know, because my daughter-in-law is from Ireland. She's from Dublin. My father-in-law loved it, you know, shots of Jameson and whatever. And our son had sent us pictures, just whatever was going on in my head. I had the thought, and I told on myself. We talked about it. She said, are you going to be okay? And I said, yes, I'm okay. And she goes, if I'm not okay, I'll tell you. That was 2 years ago. Never thought about it again. But that's where I started. And that's where that faith came from. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me as a base level. Now, to have that life that got me to Ireland, to have a woman like that, to have my children who love me, it's taken a little more work than that. But that's what the rest of the steps are for, right? As I've learned, and the gifts are real. But this journey to know God was just like that. I keep having these moments where God was just making himself known to me. His presence in my life, this feeling, either you know or you don't. And I had to address that shame. And the shame that was by me and keeping me from knowing God was thinking that I had some say in alcoholism, that I had some choice. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics drink. The miracle is that I'm not drinking. The miracle is that I'm here sober with you men. And I know a lot of you guys, like Jimmy said, and that we have been sober a long time through the grace of God, the 12 steps, our fellowship, all of it. I don't know what part I cannot do. And God keeps revealing himself to me. I had a man in my kitchen recently doing a fifth step. And God revealed himself again. We're talking and he's sharing a story. And it's if you've done the steps and you've been involved in a fifth step, you know that it's sacred to me. And it's not easy for men like us to be vulnerable and to share what's really going on with us. And the kitchen lit up. It was a gloomy day in Buffalo. You know, we get 9 whole days of sunshine a year. And for whatever reason, he was talking and sharing, and it opened up, and the sun came through, and there was God. And I've had these experiences over and over. And I've done my work, and I can see the greater difficulties that keep me from having a fantastic relationship with my wife. And it's all rooted in that selfishness, that self-centeredness, these defects of character, as we call them, and shortcomings that I need to address and be honest about. And a lot of you guys helped me with that. You might know that I prayed to you about going on a car. My kids are in college. So Plattsburgh's a long ride. My oldest now lives in North Carolina, and we go visit. Started off in Pittsburgh. If you're like me and you make the idiot comment on the car ride and you got 50, 100 miles of silence, it's not a good thing. And I don't want to be that way. I just don't. And it kind of ties into that. I didn't know that we didn't know that we didn't know, and I'm powerless. I'm powerless over my defects of characters as much as I am over the drinking. But I've also found that if I'm aware of them, like I'm aware of my drinking, and I pray to God to save me and I talk to you, man, about it, I don't have to act that way. And thank God for Step 9. Thank God for amends. And that when I do screw up, that I can go to people and ask for their apologies. I apologize to all the people on that last drunk. Thank God I apologize to those cops, and I mean it. I wound up working 25 years with those women that arrested me. One got my 6th coin, the other one got my 9-month coin. You know, apologize to all my brothers and sisters. My brother taught me that I had dominated my mother. I did not know that. I did not know that I dominated my relationship, my brother's relationship with my mother. Because every time he tried to talk to her, she told him to look out for me and take care of me. And you got to look out for your little brother. He's 12 years older than me, that one brother. I had no idea. You know, I make this list of how I hurt you. It wasn't on the list. A lot of times I have no clue how I've hurt people. So I just ask him. I've learned to just ask him. And I know there's a rub in our relationship. If I've done something to hurt you, I'm sorry. I talk a lot. I do things. As much as I don't want to be hurtful, I still am. Not like I used to be, but I still can be. And I need to be cognizant of that and aware of that. So why? So that I could have knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. And not some mystical God like I used to believe in, which was sufficient. But there came a point where I needed to get more specific, where I returned to the God of my youth and Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit to fill me. And I've learned today that there's things that I need to do, and the steps speak of it too. Whichever God that a man chooses, one of forgiveness, right? There's things that we need to do for that power to dwell in us, to really work in us, to exist. You know, the 4-step teaches us that we're blocked off from the sunlight of the Spirit when we're angry, when we're fearful, when we're chasing women or mean money. Those things fell in. But when I'm free and clear of those things, and I can know the knowledge of God's will. I know unequivocally to never drink again and do drugs is God's will for me. Every single person in my life told me. And you men around here, you guys know me. Is it ever going to be a safe time for me to do drugs again or drink? So you guys would concur with God's will, right? Yes. I see my man Kurt putting his thumb, never. And you know the beautiful thing. Now, that's a monumental for a guy who was convinced someday, somehow, control and enjoy his drink. Convinced of it. There'll be a way to go to never again, and also to be provided the power to make that possible, like George and my early mentors, and Booner McBride and those guys who died sober, Sean Cody. There's a lot of men who have passed away sober who have proven to me that this can be a permanent condition, sobriety, and that matters to me, as well as other things like, don't be a jerk to my wife. Don't make the stupid comments on a car ride, right? Pay your bills. Be a good father. Don't look for extra credit. Just do the things that men could do. If there's a failure for me in sight, it's going to be feeling or thinking that I'm a failure as a man. are not doing the things, just the simple stuff that we're supposed to do. Pay the mortgage, make the car payments, keep up on the bills, right? Keep up on cutting the grass. Just the things that we're supposed to. Nothing spectacular. Just regular guy stuff. Put my pants on one leg at a time. It just seems for a guy like me, I'm constitutionally incapable of doing those things over the long haul without a faith in God and a design for living, which really works, which I found through the 12 steps and another group of guys to do that with. I find that in you men and other men that I've known. And thank God for sponsees that keep me straight and good mentors, my sponsor, Kano, and that are on this journey with me. Because when I talk to my buddies that I grew up with, and I'm still friends with those guys from college, if I was to talk to them like I'm talking now about what not paying your bills on time, they'd look at me like, what do you got, a screw loose? What's wrong with you? Because I don't have those difficulties. They don't have imaginary conversations in their head and the total insanity that I can run into in a debate society and negotiate paying an electric bill. Well, it's 250. Well, I might need $100 in my pocket. I know I got 250, but I want to put 100 in my pocket just to walk around with it. And they don't have those kind of issues. They don't struggle with doing what's right like I do. But you men understand. And you can see how easy it is for us to get in trouble. And once that chaos returns in my life, that unmanageability, I can get in trouble really easy. And it matters that I have people that I can trust, that I can turn to, talk to, and don't judge me. Aren't critical of me. They'll just guide me along the path. It kind of seems funny when I go, hey man, pray for me. I'm taking a long car ride with the wife. I don't want to make the idiot comment. But it's not funny when you're driving 100 miles of silence because you made the asshole comment. If you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And I don't want to be that guy. So that to me is what I've been saved from. That's the spiritual awakening. And I'm even aware of that. I'm the guy that couldn't see that he had a drinking problem. That's a pretty big miss. To now be the guy who doesn't want to be an asshole on a car ride? What a gift. Talk about Easter Sunday. Talk about being reborn. Holy camole. I like having these problems. I don't want to trade with anybody. And I was promised that. I was promised a life beyond my wildest dreams. I'm not smarter than anybody here. I don't think I'm got a leg up on anyone. I'm as much a drunk as anyone that's ever walked through these doors. And the promises are as real for anyone else as they have been for me. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that the only requirement for me was a desire to stop drinking. Because I was a member even when I didn't, when my only desire was to get out of trouble. That was my first desire. And I'm grateful for that. And I needed that. And I continue to need that. Because I can get ornery and cynical and all these defects of character, a lot of them still exist within me. I just understand them. I can see them. I don't delude myself about them. And I'm praying that this spiritual awakening is not complete and that I will continue to change. Because we're promised that. A spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Well, if I'm a finished product now, and there's no more change going to occur to me, please forgive me for any wrongdoings I may do in the future. And if my wife's within listening distance, I hope she can forgive me and anybody else. But I don't think that it's over for me. I think that the spiritual change will awakening will continue to happen, and that I will continue to grow and mature and grow up as a man, mentally, physically, emotionally, and most of all spiritually, because that's the way that it's really propelled in my understanding and my experience. And a lot of those experiences I've had in the company of other people. And God makes himself known, right? Where two or more gather in his name, he is present. I get by myself too. And that's pretty awesome. And it's not the hugging the toilet bowl, praying for God for the puking to stop or to get me out of jail. Now they're more, but those were my humble beginnings. Where I am today in my prayer life and where God has brought me to is far more. As we say, altruistic. It's far more about wanting people around me to be safe and to be of maximum use to my fellow man, my family, and those about me. And to just be there when needed. Jimmy asked this week, and I need somebody. And I thought, oh, I'll offer my services up. If you find somebody else, bring them on. Right, Jen? That's what I said. You get another guy to step up, let him step up, I'll step aside. But if you got nobody else, I'll do it. And he had nobody else. So here I am doing it. And I thank you, men. And I thank God most of all. Have a good one.